Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and this is a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Thank you for joining us for a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast on Mental Health News Radio Network. This podcast is also available wherever you get your podcasts, but I do suggest checking out Mental Health News Radio Network to find all your podcasts related to mental health. Today's guest is Kendra Petty, author of the true crime memoir, I Cannot Believe I'm Not Dead, Escaping Abuse, Occult, Attempted Murder, and Other Insanities. Far from being your typical memoir, this is both an inspirational story of resilience, grit, and perseverance, as well as a jaw-dropping thriller that proves that some lives are really stranger than fiction. Kendra, that really pulls you in. Like, how do you not open the book at this point? And I can't imagine what it was like writing the story, because this was your life.
It is my life. Laura Lee, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's an honor. It has been just a really bizarre and insane life, which is about five years ago when I started my healing process. I kind of hit a wall and said, I've got to stop this cycle of trauma and tragedy that continues to happen to me, not just in my childhood, but also throughout my adulthood. And when I hit that wall and really started digging in, trying to figure out how to heal my heart, my mind, my body, my soul, about a year into that, I decided to write the book. I did use a ghostwriter. I can't take all the credit. A ghostwriter helped me put it in a methodical, readable format. But it took 3 years, and it was definitely a labor of love and hate sometimes, because the stories are so traumatic.
Wow. Can you share a little bit about your childhood? Because you experienced some extreme childhood traumas, not just like these micro traumas. They were it wasn't just one or two. It was just a massive, just so much complex trauma there.
There really is. And, I look back and once I put it all down in writing and started reading it and editing it and re-editing, I was like, holy cow, this is nuts. And I knew I had had a very traumatic childhood. I was born in Oklahoma, born on a farm. I was the second oldest. I had an older brother and then a younger brother. We weren't raised on the farm. We moved around Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas when my dad decided to leave farming and go into radio. So he was a DJ for a very long time and had shows. And so we moved a lot to move to bigger stations and better time slots and et cetera. And we settled in a city or town called Lawton, Oklahoma. My mother was always very mentally unstable and always had mental illness. And so as we were young, my older brother and I, there was a lot of screaming and yelling and sort of 911, hair on fire. But when I was 8 and my older brother was 10, he was my best friend, and we were playing together. We went fishing, and we were crossing a highway, and he was making sure, per my mom's instructions, to get me back across the highway safe for a birthday party. And in that crossing, he got hit and killed by a car going probably about 70 or 75 miles an hour. And I was trying to warn him that the car was coming, and he was trying to tell me that it was safe. And it was, the last thing he saw was me. We were looking in each other's eyes, and it was horrific. It's a scene that to this day plays over and over in my mind. It was horrendous and grotesque and very violent. And the aftermath of that was, of course, that led to survivor's guilt for me, because he was trying to make sure I was safe, and he died and I did not. But it also led to a lifetime of night terrors, just horrible night terrors. I would run out of houses and hotel rooms and wake up in strange places and sometimes injure myself. Occasionally injure someone that might be sleeping with me. It also led to just a tremendous amount of guilt for me, that I felt like it was my fault that my brother had died. But what that did to my family was it made my mother go even madder. She really just went into a dark abyss of severe mental illness. My father left us. My mother was very physically abusive, extremely physically abusive, and very verbally and emotionally abusive. Every day, like I said, was 911, hair on fire. There was never a day where you could just be at peace. You always walked on eggshells and wondered, when would it happen and what would it be to set her off? And usually it was nothing that you would think would set her off. It was just her really deep, dark mental illness that she just couldn't sustain in life. So I spent 18 years with her and her abuse. And then finally, in the middle of my senior year, I had enough. And I ran out of the house and I kept running and I never looked back.
Wow. Wow. Like I that is that I can't even imagine how difficult it is just having to be in that situation where you see the death of your brother, your mom. Just I can imagine having survivor's guilt. And but you left at 18.
Did.
Yeah. When did you realize, like, I'm assuming you went several years of your life with this trauma and picking up different traumas along the way?
Yeah, and I think, you know, to add to that, there was a few other situations that were very abusive. A babysitter who sexually abused me for about 3 years. And then my mother remarried after my father left. My mother remarried a man, and they started a church in our home. That morphed into this just very bizarre cult, religious cult that paved the way for more abuse. Things like we weren't allowed to go to the doctor because they would pray over us and God would heal, so we didn't get proper medical care. We weren't allowed to associate with anyone outside of the church. We weren't allowed to watch TV or listen to the radio or
which is read bizarre. The you were living with a radio host,
right?
But
right.
Well, he had left.
They divorced. Yeah. But yeah, in the book, I talk about a situation where my mother, because she believed all secular music was of the devil, that she made me bring all of my dad's albums that he'd given me as they take albums and records back then out of the circulation to play. Back then they threw them away or gave them away. And my dad gave me a lot. And she had this whole ceremony to dance around them and cast the devil out of them and break them with hammers and her feet and then throw them away. It was pretty devastating. But there was a lot of craziness like that associated with the religion, a lot of ceremonies and casting out of the devil and praying in tongues and screaming and yelling in tongues and, you know, in public. And it was very unsettling. And I could never rectify my mother's religion with how abusive she was, because if God was supposed to be a God of love, why was she choking me till I blacked out when I was younger, but severely beating me as I got older? But I can look back now and I know that it was just my mother's mental illness for the most part.
Was there any responsible adult who you could turn to?
You know, back then, well, first, I don't think I didn't realize not everyone was living like this, because we were raised in a bubble. So I just didn't know. I knew it wasn't right. And I knew I wasn't happy. I knew I hated it. But my two stepsisters and my brother also saw all of her. They didn't really get the brunt of her abuse, physical abuse, but they definitely saw all of her outbursts. And, you know, we would be driving down the highway and something would make her mad and she would try to jump out of a moving car. We'd have to pull over and she'd run off in the field and we'd have to wait for her to come back, you know, putting everyone in danger. So back then, there wasn't the education there is today of what's right and what's wrong. I think kids today know what's right and what's wrong. And they know that most of them know that there's resources out there. You hear about kids calling police on babysitters or parents or grandparents. But back then, that just wasn't the structure and the culture.
Wow. So then there was this cult that you lived in.
Yeah.
You didn't fall for it though. You knew that this was not right. And how old were you when this cult started?
12 or maybe 13, so 5 or 6 years that I lived in it. And you know, I we Oklahoma is part of the Bible Belt, so I was sprinkled Methodist when I was born. We were raised Baptist. We went to the Methodist church while we were on the farm because that was my father's religion. But when we left the farm, my mother's father was my grandfather was a Baptist preacher, and so we changed from Methodist to Baptist and went to a Baptist church. So we were always involved in the church, but it was, you know, that typical Sunday morning church, occasionally a Wednesday night or occasionally a Sunday night. But you know, there was no reading of the Bible at home, no praying or anything that like that. It happened at church. But when the cult started, it was all God, all Bible, all the time. That's all we talked about. I mean, we didn't talk about our feelings or our emotions. We didn't talk about what was going on in our lives or how we felt. It was only God, only Bible. We went to a Christian school when we came home. So we studied the Bible and went to school. We came home, we'd study the Bible and pray and memorize scripture and do our homework. And then we would go to church in the evenings or have church in our home. The cult started in our home and it grew and it grew and it grew to bigger buildings and such. I think it might still be in existence. At least the building is still there. But I didn't subscribe to it. I knew that it was really over the top for me. But I did, you know, growing up, I did believe in God. Today, I don't really know where I stand with all of that. I do believe in a higher power. I definitely don't believe in the Bible or organized religion, but I do believe that there's some sort of a higher power.
Wow. And you know, in your title, a cult, you escaped a cult. That's you left in an attempted murder. Can
So
you elaborate?
you know, I left in the middle of my senior year. I left and moved in with my dad and finished out my senior year. And then I moved to New York City for 8 years. I lived there and I went to college there and loved it until I decided I didn't like the cold. But it was an incredible escape for me to get out of Oklahoma, get away from my mother, get away from all that craziness, even though I was living with my father. And so I went to university, and my only focus was building a career, making a lot of money, being able to sustain myself, live a very good life. I wasn't really interested in getting married or having kids. I just wanted to focus on a career. And I think that was, for me, an escape. And it was different than how I was raised. Everybody, where I was raised, the women would get married and have kids and, you know, settle in Oklahoma. And there's not a lot of big careers or anything like that. Or back then, there wasn't. So I worked really hard to build a career and focused on that. And while I was in New York, I came out as gay. I realized I was gay. Although growing up, I didn't know what that meant. We didn't talk about those sorts of things. And so I dated a lot and I had some relationships, but my focus was my career. And when I left New York City, I moved to Los Angeles, and that's where I started in the industry that I'm still in today. I started moving, climbing the ladder, and moving a lot for this company. I was with them as an executive for almost 15 years, and I moved just a ton because that was their mantra. If you wanted to move up in the company, you had to geographically move. So you know, LA to Dallas to San Antonio to Atlanta, Chicago, Cleveland, San Francisco, and then when I left them, I made probably four other moves with another company. But I joined a firm on the heels of my divorce. I ended up, when I lived in San Francisco, I married a woman who had a daughter. So I had a stepdaughter who came into my life when she was 7. Unbeknownst to me, my wife was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And I was seeing these behaviors while we were dating, before we married, and I knew that things weren't right. But when you come from an abusive home, your bar for ridiculousness is so high. And I just thought, this woman is, she's got some mental issues like my mother. And so I would tell her, you know, either you have some mental issues or you're doing drugs. Either way, we've got to get you some help. I'm not doing drugs. I'm not crazy. But because I was raised in such a bubble, I didn't understand drugs or alcohol. and didn't know the signs, didn't know where to go get help. And so she was extremely physically abusive, extremely. She broke my bones on multiple occasions.
Oh my gosh.
I've got scars all over my body from her. It was another situation of 911 hair on fire all over again for 6 years. I had her arrested. It took me a long time to unwind from that because I never wanted to get married and have kids. And then I decided to, and because she loved it so much and I loved her, I really started embracing marriage and children and family for the first time in my life. And so I really felt like I needed to work to help her. And after 6 years, I realized that I couldn't. And it was very hard for me to let them go. I moved them back to San Antonio, which is where they're from. But on the heels of that, I left the firm that I had been with for almost 15 years and joined a firm as the number two under the CEO, as the executive vice president running. They owned a group of companies and I oversaw three of those companies. They, unbeknownst to me, were involved in organized crime. And as these things that they were doing started to, it took some time. Again, my naivety and not knowing what the mafia looked like and what, you know, money laundering and tax evasion and, you know, pay to play bribery for contracts and such, and a number of other things that they were doing, not knowing what that looked like, it took time for me to start saying, what is happening here? And then I started questioning. And then I started pushing back on some of the things, still not really understanding that it was, that what they were doing was illegal. I just pushed back on some of the processes and I started to question them. And then things really started going sideways. I found a listening device in my office, remnants of one in my car, and realized that they had been listening to me when I thought I was having private conversations with my friends or my family or my girlfriend. And, you know, some of the things I said about them in what I thought were those private conversations was not very nice because of the things that they were doing and sort of the loggerheads that we had come to. I was so frustrated that the CEO had convinced me to leave such an upstanding career and come be his number two to run these companies, only to find that they weren't really in the industry to do what I, you know, it's the parking and transportation industry. And I just, you know, back then I was like, I just want to park cars. Like, I just want to run these companies and do the right thing. And what you guys are doing, this makes no sense. And once I found the listening devices, about 3 months later, I started getting sick, very, very sick. And I couldn't figure out what it was. My skin turned gray. I developed sores in my mouth and down my throat and in my ears. My eyes got very puffy. I had terrible headaches. My voice got really raspy. I could barely talk. My joints, everything hurt. And I would walk through the office and people would say, "What is the matter with you, Kendra?" And I would say, "I don't know, but I am so sick. I don't know what it is." And it took some time. You know, I searched my office. I started to realize that when I would leave my office and go to a conference room or travel, the symptoms would dissipate some. So I started looking around my office thinking that it was like mold or something in the vents, and I couldn't find anything. I wasn't looking for any poisons. I was just looking for, you know, maybe mold growing in the vents or something. Right. Couldn't find anything, continued to get sick. And then one day I dropped, and they always kept it very cold in my office because I have short hair. So they always kept it very cold. So I always wore scarves around my neck because it was freezing in that office, and I had a space heater underneath my desk. Well, one day I dropped something under my desk and I went down under to pick it up, and I saw these pods up under my desk, and I immediately knew that's what was making me sick. And I thought, this heater has been heating these pods up and I've been breathing it. You know, the right side of my face, I thought was going to burn off. And I thought my right eyeball was going to burn out of its socket. It hurt so bad. And so I pulled them off. I called a guy that worked for me that was a friend in Chicago, and told him what I found. And he's a good friend. He knew I'd been sick, and I told him what I found. And I was like, "What the hell?" I made my assistant search our whole office with me, and it was we had a half of a floor of a Class A office building on like the 33rd floor. It was beautiful offices, and it was huge. We searched the entire office. It was a huge office. Not another pod except the two under my desk and one under my refrigerator. And I had a big office, a very big office. I had a couch and table and chairs and a fridge and a credenza and a desk. And, you know, you could put those pods anywhere, but they were up under my desk. And anyway, long story short, as we moved forward, I found poisons in my office, in my home, and in my car. I was unknowingly ingesting them.
What were these pods?
Wearing them. There were poisons in them. I don't know what was in them.
Oh my God.
Definitely poisons. I touched one of them by accident and scratched my face, and it burned a sore onto my face. They were that strong. So I was unknowingly ingesting them, breathing them in, wearing them on my clothes. So each time I would find some, I would remove them. And I had a corporate apartment in another city. So I traveled to get away, and I stayed away for a while, and I just started to figure out my exit strategy. I was like, oh my God, these people, are they just trying to scare me? Are they trying to kill me? And I was so sick that it took some time to figure out that they were really trying to kill me. And they killed a CEO. He was murdered. So I'm lucky to be alive. But I did eventually leave there. But about 4 months after removing myself from all those poisons, those symptoms started to dissipate.
Oh my gosh.
And about 4 months later, a whole new series of symptoms started coming on, a whole different array. And so I started seeing a doctor because I was sick all over again, but a different kind of sick. I lost weight. I went down to 92 pounds. I lost half my hair. I was just very, very sick again. And so then I started seeing a doctor, and I was eventually diagnosed with Graves' disease. And Graves' disease is a autoimmune disease that is not curable. You can put it in remission, although I struggled with keeping it in remission for over 10 years. But it can be brought on by genetics, it does not run in my family, or there can be triggers. And two of the biggest triggers are exposure to chemicals and multiple infections. And after I got sick during that 4 months, I was in and out of the ER with lots of infections. It killed my immune system. So I couldn't fight off anything. So I was, you know, UTI infection, bladder infection, sinus infection, chest infection. I scratched myself shaving and I got a staph infection. So I was always in the ER. Gosh. And the gentleman that I mentioned before, he took me to the ER a few times. Like, he really took care of me through that illness and helped me out. He was someone that I could turn to, and I felt safe with him. And he's still a very dear friend today. But so I developed Graves' disease, and I fought that for many years. And I said to my friends, and I left that company. I joined the company that I'm still with today. I've been with this company for over 13 years. And I said to my friends early on, if I ever get cancer, it's going to be because of those poisons. Never thinking I would get cancer. Ever, ever, ever thinking I would get cancer. It doesn't run in my family. And then 7.5 years after exposure to those chemicals, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. The gestation period for cancer when exposed to chemicals is 7 to 8 years. And I was diagnosed at 7.5 years. And the minute that they called me and told me that I had breast cancer and that I needed to come in and start figuring out my treatment plan, I knew immediately. I knew immediately that it was those people. So it's been a crazy journey, for sure. A crazy life. But, you know, I've really done in the last 5 years a lot of work to heal. And I'm very lucky to be alive. And I'm very grateful for the life that I live. I love that you use surviving and thriving. That I talk about that in my book. And I talk about it in all my podcasts, that I've learned to not just be a survivor, but I've learned to thrive in this life in spite of everything that I've been through.
That is amazing. It is unbelievable what you have had experienced. And I know we're just kind of scratching the surface here. Definitely read the book, and you'll find that in the show notes. But how did you decide, I want to start healing? When was the moment where you were like, something needs to change?
Yeah. No, that's a good question. I was always a very social person, always, and loved to throw parties, and had a lot of friends, and was just very active, and never an introvert as an adult. But when I realized that they were trying to murder me and that I had escaped I had narrowly escaped being killed, I was very fearful for my life for many, many years. I was scared to death of them coming back after me because they were not successful in killing me. So I really shut down. I didn't allow people in my home for years and years and years. I didn't make new friends. I still moved a lot for work. I didn't make new friends. I would only associate with family and friends that I had before all that happened because I knew I could trust them. I closed down all my social media. I would date, but I never got too close to anyone. And I just shut down and lived in fear, looked over my shoulder all the time. You know, anytime I'd get in and out of my car, I'm looking around, I'm looking in the rearview mirror. I was always very hyper aware of my surroundings, no matter where I was. And about 5 years ago, I just hit a wall and said, this is ridiculous. Like you're living like a hobbit and, you know, no friends. I had moved to another city and had lived there for a couple of years and didn't have any friends. And it was ridiculous. So when I hit that wall and said, I've got to change my life, I've got to stop living in fear. I really sought to understand how I could heal myself. And I started reading and digging in and working with different kinds of healers, like in Sedona, energy healers, wow. And just doing a lot of reading and listening to interviews and podcasts and self-help things. Even though my whole life I was never a self-help kind of person, I knew at that point that if I wanted to live a life of thriving and love, that I needed to change the way I was living. So that was part of the process. There were so many things I did in that 5 years, so many things I still do. I was just in Sedona last weekend, and I find that to be very healing. And when I'm there, I always want to work with different kinds of healers to help me and then take practices back with me to continue to heal.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah, I know. Healing, recovery, it is really just like a lifelong journey, right?
It is. It really is.
There's so much to do, and all very worth it. I mean, with everything you've been through, I love that you're thriving and that you're sharing your story. And you know, it's really hard for trauma survivors who are very like vigilant of their surroundings as children to know what the difference is between like toxic relationships. I mean, they're just like, oh, that's just the relationship I went through when I was a kid. Like this, right. Like you were saying, this must be normal. This must be how everyone lives their life. But you know, and it's really hard to kind of pull yourself out of that. I feel like the ridiculousness of your story is so, it was like just so many signs like this is not right. And you deep down in your soul, you're like, this is not right. How do you deal with toxic relationships? After you left home, did you have a relationship with your mother? All these people in your life, were you able to cut them out clean out of your life?
I finally did. With my mother, when I would go back to Oklahoma, I would go see her for just a bit. We did end up having to, my younger brother and I ended up having to put her in a home after her husband passed because she just couldn't function and take care of herself. And, you know, she's really once an abuser, always an abuser. And so she was abusive to my stepfather, which was heartbreaking. He developed Lewy body dementia. He was such a good man. Mm. Although, you know, there was still part of that. He was involved in the cult and such, but, you know, he lost his wife, which was my mom's best friend. Oh. And so she lost her son and then her husband and then her best friend. And he lost his wife and they came together and they got married. And so I think in all the grief that they were going through, I think that's sort of how the cult came to be. They were seeking comfort in each other and in religion and in God. But when I left, I would see my mom on occasion. And then when we put her in a home because my stepfather died, she would not take care of herself. She wouldn't go outside. I mean, it was really a sad situation. And so we put her in an assisted living. She was early 60s or 65. So way too young to be in an assisted living, but she just could not function in the real world without someone taking care of her. And she kept getting moved around to different places. They would say, we don't deal with this. This is not what we do. Her severe mental illness. Right. Well, now she's, you know, that was 16 years ago or so, and she's been in hospice for the last 2 years. They call it failure to thrive, and she'll get better, and then she'll get worse, and she'll get better, but she's still alive. But I don't, 5 years ago when I hit that wall, you know, I was up until 5 years ago, I was not very good at managing and adhering to red flags that I saw or setting boundaries. I went through my life with friends, with girlfriends, with my wife, even continuing to associate with my mom some, dealing with that toxicity. And 5 years ago, when I really was like, I got to clean up my life. Like, I really have to make changes so that I can live a life of peace and happiness. One of the things I did was I cut out a lot of friends that were toxic. And I continue to do that. If I meet people and they come into my circle and I find them to be toxic, they have to go, at least in my life. They don't have to go from my friends' lives, but they have to go from my life. If I meet someone to date and I get those red flags, I immediately cut it off. So I've gotten so much better in the last 5 years. And I did go to tell my mother goodbye when she first went into hospice. Originally, I was like, no, I don't need to. I don't really talk to her much. But for me, when I thought about it, when my brother called me to say she's going into hospice, if you want to say goodbye to her, you should do so soon. And that was 2 years ago. I went to Oklahoma and I sat with her for 3 days, not all day long, but you know, blocks during those 3 days. And I held her hand and I stroked her head and I told her I loved her because and I didn't mean any of it. Like I don't have any hate for my mom, but I also don't have any like strong love feelings. I have no attachment feelings to her whatsoever. But I felt like because she's lived such a tortured life, I really wanted her to pass with peace in this life into whatever is her next life, whatever that is. I don't know what it is, but whatever that is, I wanted her to pass feeling loved, feeling respected, and in peace so that she wouldn't take all this angst into whatever that is next for her. So it was for her, didn't do anything for me. I did not like doing it, but I did it because I felt like it was the right thing for her. But now it's been 2 years and she still has not passed on. And that makes me sad for her because she's been bedridden for several years now and is in pain. And it's just a
Oof.
terrible, terrible situation.
What is your relationship with your brother?
My younger brother, it's good. I mean, we've been very close. It was really hard to leave him when I left at 18 because he's 6.5 years younger than me, and that was why I never moved in with my dad to begin with, because I could have at 13 in Oklahoma, I could have left and moved in with my dad. But that manipulation from an abuser is a big part of why people stay, and I did it twice in my life with my mother and with my wife. But I also didn't want to leave my brother with my mother, and I eventually just got to the point. The beatings were so brutal that I could not stay. I was thinking of ways to kill myself. I mean, it was just that bad a situation. So I moved in with my dad, and when my dad saw my body from that beating, and he had his wife take pictures, he was infuriated. I had cuts, I had bruises and welts, and she pulled out parts of my hair, and he wanted to press charges. And I said, you know, I don't think I can go through that. I'm gone. I've left. I'm never going back. So we didn't press charges. But my relationship with my brother is good. He's going through some things right now. Unfortunately, my heart breaks for him because I love him so much. I love all my brothers. I have step and half brothers, and I have stepsisters, and I love my whole family. But he's going through some tough times. So I tried to call him yesterday. We didn't get to connect, but hopefully he can find a path to healing. He did not know my brother. He was one when he passed, but you know, he did see my mother and go he went through all of that. And that, you know, healing from that, as you said, it can take a lifetime.
It can definitely take a lifetime. Wow. Oh my gosh, there's just so much. It's like, how do you cover all of it? And I guess you write a book, right? You know, your story, it is very unique in that there's just extreme trauma after extreme trauma. But you know, I feel like a lot of people go through a lot of trauma, not necessarily these extreme traumas, but it can be debilitating, you know, for individuals, right? What is your message to all these people who are struggling, with you know, these toxic relationships that they had been in, especially within family members, and kind of moving forward in life and finding healing and where to start.
Yeah, it is hard to figure out where to start. I think first and foremost, I tell people do not get stuck. And listen, I've been stuck a number of times. I've stuck 18 years with my mother. I was stuck 6 years with my wife. I was stuck 3 years with a psychopath CEO who tried to murder me. So I've been stuck plenty. And now I realize, and now I have a very short, you know, I very quickly will move on from toxic situations. So my first message to people is do not get stuck. Don't get stuck in a toxic situation or relationship. Don't get stuck in blame. Don't get stuck in anger. The only way you can move on, and I know this has been my practice my whole life, not just starting 5 years ago, is I never got stuck in a woe is me, ever, ever, ever. It was never, oh, poor me. It was, I got up, I continued on, I forged ahead, and I just, you know, I kept my eyes on the prize, which was living a happy life and having a successful career. But while you're, you know, sometimes it takes time to figure out how to get unstuck. So whilst you are trying to figure out how to get unstuck, you have to find things that help you heal. And you have to find things that bring you joy. So for me, it was laughter. My father's very funny. My brother's very funny. You know, so on that side of the family, I grew up, you know, laughing a lot with them. So I knew that I needed things that made me laugh because that helped me feel better as I was trying to get out of these situations or heal. But a couple of the other things that I did, there's so many things I did, but another big thing that I did was I started practicing gratitude. And I'd always been very grateful for my adult life that I'd created and the success in my career. But I really dug in and started practicing gratitude on a whole different level for everything in my life on a daily basis. And it makes a huge difference. Third, I started practicing forgiveness. And that's a real hard one for me. Practicing forgiveness for all those that have harmed me, which there's been so many, but also forgiveness for myself, forgiveness for allowing myself to be in those situations for so long, forgiveness for what's happened to my brother. But I'm not quite there yet. I work every day at it. Like you said, it's a lifelong process. But lastly is really letting my walls down and letting love back in, letting people back in. And that was so hard for me to do. And again, it's work that I do on a continual basis. But, you know, the only way to learn how to thrive is to practice gratitude, practice forgiveness, and open your heart to love.
Wow. Yes. Gratitude is such a powerful, powerful thing because you don't realize it. I know for me, it was just like, what am I grateful for? You know, when I was struggling with what I was, when I was dealing with, you know, my own personal trauma and trying to heal and starting my recovery journey, it was really difficult, but then it definitely got easier. The more you do it, it's like a practice. It's like meditation. You know, I was just like, meditate. Why would people meditate? Like, why would you just sit in silence? And, you know, I had no idea. I had no idea what it was like to calm your brain down because I thought that it was normal for my brain to be going a mile a minute. And if it stopped, then what was the point? And there's just so much peace in the calm because I was like always seeking chaos because that is all I knew.
Right. Yep. No, I get it. And practicing gratitude rewrites neuropathways. So it really does change things for you. And it was so evident for me, the shift that I felt internally when I started really focusing on gratitude.
Oh, so beautiful. Wow. What a story. What a life. And what an amazing, it's just so inspiring just seeing you and you are just your energy, your positive energy. It's beautiful. I can feel it. I can feel it through the screen. Is there anything that you would like to add?
I know I'm lucky to be alive. One of the things that I did throughout my healing process was I needed a daily reminder for myself of how lucky and fortunate and blessed I am to be alive and to be thriving. And I didn't, you know, it couldn't be a post-it note on a mirror. It couldn't be a post-it note in my car. I needed it on my person so that I could look at it every day and remind myself. And I didn't have any tattoos until, I guess it's been 3 or 4 years since I've had this tattoo, but I had a tattoo on my left palm that says lucky, so that when I am feeling frustrated or down or not happy with my life or scared, I can look at my palm and I can remind myself that I'm lucky to be alive and lucky to be here and lucky to be living the life that I am and that I'm thriving in life, not just surviving.
That's incredible. Thank you so much, Kendra, for joining me today. I really appreciate you sharing your story. And I know there is just so much more in the book. So I do encourage anyone to check out the book. There's a link to the show notes. Kendra, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Loralee. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. That was Kendra Petty, author of the true crime memoir, I Cannot Believe I'm Not Dead, Escaping Abuse, Occult, Attempted Murder, and Other Insanities. For more information on Kendra and where to purchase her book, again, check out the show notes. April's issue of Authentic Insider is out. Check out Authentic Insider at TraumaSurvivorThriver.com. That's TraumaSurvivorThriver.com. She has also contributed to April's issue, so please check that out. We'll have a link also in the show notes. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the email list to get Authentic Insider magazine in your inbox monthly. You've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. I'm Loralee Binstock. Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation. Take care.